Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the creation of a new intelligence agency, not by the US government, but by Charles and David Koch of the Koch brothers, who have hired a competitive intelligence team of 25, including one former CIA analyst, to thwart liberal groups and activists. Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico and author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking of American Politics, joins us. He broke the story in Politico, and we will discuss his latest article, The Koch Intelligence Agency, and the efforts by the billionaire brothers to spy on Democrats while rooting out moles within their own ranks. Then we will speak with Christopher Swift, a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia Center for National Security Law. He's the author of The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad, and we will discuss whether the West is giving Daesh, the Islamic State, exactly what they want with the nativist response to the Paris massacres by U.S. governors shutting the door on Syrian refugees, which reinforces the clash of civilizations model that Daesh is trying to inflame. Then finally, we'll go to Geneva, Switzerland, and speak with Joel Millman, the press officer for the International Organization of Migration, who previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. We'll discuss how much attitudes in Europe have changed towards the influx of refugees from Syria since the massacres in Paris. And joining us now is Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign trail, traveling during the 2008 race with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. He's the author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking of American Politics, and his latest article at Politico is The Koch Intelligence Agency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Vogel.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Ian.
Well, Ken, I'm amazed by your article and what you've uncovered here. And, you know, it's one thing to learn that the United States government has created a new intelligence agency, because after all, we've got an alphabet soup of about 16 intelligence agencies in the government in Washington, D.C., but here we have, you've uncovered the fact that Charles and David Koch of the Koch brothers have hired a competitive intelligence team of 25, including one former CIA analyst. And I take it their marching orders are to thwart liberal groups and activists.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. They are attempting to essentially do surveillance and gather intelligence on what the professional left is doing. We talk about the professional left being unions, environmental groups, Democratic campaigns, super PACs, party committees. And the reason why they're doing this is because, of course, they've been investing increasingly in politics over the last several years. And after the 2012 presidential campaign, during which they spent a ton of money, more than $400 million, it was really like their coming out party into big money, overt big money politics. And they didn't get a whole lot for that. In fact, Barack Obama was reelected president, Senate stayed in Democratic hands, and they were disappointed. And they did a forensic audit to determine sort of what went wrong and how they could spend their money more efficiently. And one of the key findings was that the left had just outmaneuvered them, both on the ground in terms of organizing and the ad wars, in terms of data, and they wanted to both build up their own capabilities so that they could compete with what the left was doing, or what they thought that the left was doing, in a more efficient way, but also they wanted to figure out what the left was doing and be able to track it in real time so that they could respond in real time. The idea being that if they found out that a union was organizing or was registering voters or doing get-out-the-vote work in a particular district that they had an interest in, well, they would need to counter that. They would need to send their own ground forces to go and do organizing to offset what the liberals are doing, at least rally their base to come out and vote. And how would you do that? How would you be able to effectively direct your resources to counter what the left is doing if you don't know what the left is doing? That's the idea behind this competitive intelligence group.
Yeah, but Kenneth Vogel, when you say the professional left, it almost sounds like an oxymoron or the old joke by Will Rogers, I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some of that, although one of the main things, one of the main reasons why the Kochs sort of got involved in politics in the first place, or where they saw their potential niche with some of the ground organizing that they were doing, where the right has really just not been as efficient as the left and has not spent as much money as the left in getting out the vote, doing door-to-door retail politicking. That in large part has to do with the unions. Organized labor has traditionally done a very good job of rallying its members and investing in this type of activity. But then also there is sort of more of an activist base on the left, or has been, around some of the key causes that animate the left, including abortion rights, including environmental protection and fighting climate change, than there has been on the right. And so the Kochs essentially tried to build from whole cloth, their political network did, sort of a commensurate army of activists who would go out and do this type of thing, and that's expensive, and they've invested a lot of money in doing it. So far, the results are kind of mixed. They do very well, as does the right as a whole in the Republican Party, in off-year elections, the midterm elections. But when the turnout is very high and the Democratic and liberal groups really kick into gear with some of this ground organizing, the right and the Kochs and the Republican Party have not done as well.
So would they be aware of the fact that perhaps people that are being paid by them on the right are not necessarily as dedicated activists as the people on the left who are not being paid, but who are motivated by the very issues that you pointed out, not the least of which would be the Koch brothers themselves? I mean, you know, the Democrats in many ways run against the Koch brothers. Bernie Sanders is running against the Koch brothers.
Yeah, that's right, and I think that they're aware of that. I think that actually bothers them, and they've invested a good bit of money in recent years in a PR campaign to try to burnish their image a little bit and show that they're not entirely the stereotype that the left sort of makes them out to be. That is that, you know, this idea that they're spending all this money simply to pad their bottom line and to elect politicians who they think are going to be better for them on taxes and environmental regulation and other issues. You know, there may be some of that, but certainly their activism involvement in politics and public policy in recent years has focused on a number of issues where there's very little to no bottom line impact for them, such as criminal justice reform and fighting the export-import bank. So they've tried to get that message out there. On your question as to whether the left is more motivated and the ground troops and activists on the left are simply more motivated because they care more passionately about these set of issues, I think there has been some of that. But I think that in 2009 and 2010, with the rise of the Tea Party protest movement, we did see a real grassroots base of legit activists, grassroots activists, who were rising up. And what the Kochs did so effectively, you know, there's some, I think there's a tendency on the left to see the Tea Party as like totally astroturf and just bought and paid for by the Kochs and other wealthy donors. And that overlooks the very real motivations that these activists had to get involved in the first place. It doesn't, however, necessarily mean that the Kochs and the groups that they had set up and the groups that other wealthy conservatives and conservative foundations had set up didn't work to harness that energy and to give those activists resources and platforms to get and stay involved. So there's a little bit of an oversimplification by the left on both the motivations of the Kochs and the caricature of the Kochs, and then also the idea that the Tea Party was sort of astroturf as opposed to legitimately grassroots. Those are both like very nuanced calculations and assessments of people's motivations that I don't think can or should be painted with too broad a brush.
And again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Vogel, who's the chief investigative reporter for Politico. He tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence, and he's the author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. And his latest article at Politico is The Koch Intelligence Agency. So in many ways, it would seem from your article, Ken, that the competitive intelligence team that the Kochs have set up also is as much engaged in intelligence as it is in counterintelligence. They apparently are pretty paranoid by leaks and moles, And a friend of mine, Lauren Windsor, was able to infiltrate their meeting down in Orange County recently and actually get recordings inside the secret conclave of millionaires and billionaires over a weekend at a luxury resort where they had all kinds of workshops, including one that sort of basically talks about the need for intelligence. And apparently they, according to your article, they've sleuthed on a Greenpeace activist, and they're all the time looking for moles because clearly somebody got inside those conclaves and recorded what happened.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I cite those recordings and transcripts thereof in the story. And in fact, I've used those recordings in other stories as well, because they are a treasure trove of information about how these folks and their donors talk when they don't think that anyone is listening. But the fact that there are people who are so intent on recording this, and as you put it, like with Bernie Sanders or American Bridge, the David Brock run group, running against the Koch brothers, it shows that, in fact, there is this interest in getting inside the operation and pulling back the curtain. And so it sort of makes sense that they would be very deliberative. You use the word paranoid. I wouldn't use that word, but very deliberative about attempting to assess and root out these potential leaks and threats because they're real.
So, but what is also real, clearly, Ken, is that there are people on the inside who do leak this. You don't get into those Koch conclaves unless you're a millionaire or a billionaire, as far as I know.
Right. Well, I've been inside, but not for long. You're right. Keep a pretty close eye out. And so that's right. And that's also part of it, is to figure out, what people inside are doing, because, as is the case with the left and major liberal groups and political parties and campaigns, there are people who talk to the press, and it is our job in the press to get those people to talk to us and to continue to talk to us and hopefully leak us all kinds of great documents and details and stuff like that. And it is the job of those entities to be on the lookout for those types of things and try to mitigate those risks. So some of this, what is striking about some of this to me, a couple of things that are very striking. One of them is, this is pretty standard practice in corporate America, and the Kochs have really gone to great lengths to try to apply corporate management techniques and corporate structures to their political activity and the political activity of the donors who they convene twice a year at these seminars that you alluded to. So this in some ways is, I think, the Competitive Intelligence Unit, the focus on the investment in it, stems from that, the desire to apply corporate structures to political work. And so that's a little bit new. There are certainly opposition research groups and certainly a constant effort to sleuth out leakers and moles. But I think the way that they're doing this is new and is unique. The second thing that I would say that struck me in writing this story was that this is not necessarily about getting Oppo to plant a hit piece on someone, which is how we traditionally think about political opposition research. This is rather to tailor and to continue to refine their efforts, both in real time, as we discussed, and then sort of more broadly forward in a forward-looking way, because they don't see this as just about one election and beating one person. Sure, that may be part of it in certain instances. They see this really about changing American public life and the way that we think about this balance between taxation and regulation and social services and capitalism and the free market. They want to shift that balance fundamentally, and they are committed, and they've continued to invest in, even as they've had setbacks like in 2012, in this effort. And so this is really the competitive intelligence part is about figuring out what the other side is doing to counter their efforts and counter that and incorporate some of the best practices from the other side in a way that I think will be borne out over many, many years if they have their way.
So how do they operate, though, in terms of, obviously there's this fiction that these political action committees and 501c3s and 501c4s, like the myriad of vehicles that the Kochs and Karl Rove use, they operate under this sort of somewhat thin rubric that they don't coordinate with the official campaigns or with the RNC itself. So in terms of, if you're, running a campaign or a crusade, if for that matter, which appears to be the case in the broad terms that you just outlined the Koch brothers' ambitions, arguably the Republican Party are your vehicle, but you're not supposed to talk to them. So what goes on in terms of the strategic planning, you know, not just the tactics, which is what some of the intelligence people of the Kirks are trying to find out, but what do you make of their strategic planning and how do they coordinate and how do they decide who to back and who not to back?
Well, they can certainly coordinate and do coordinate with, you know, within the Koch network, crusade to crusade, as you put it. Where they can't coordinate is with the campaigns of the party committees. And so, you know, there are certainly times, and they don't pretend as if they're, you know, as if they're apolitical, nor do they pretend as if they're, like, totally separate from the Republican Party. They want to change the Republican Party, and that's something that they're doing. And so to that extent, they don't want to necessarily coordinate with them in any kind of more macro way. But certainly there are races and instances in which their interests coincide. And so part of the remit of this competitive intelligence agency within the Koch network is to figure out what the right is doing and what other groups of the right are doing, including the Republican Party. So, for instance, I obtained this memo, this intelligence briefing that was sent by this competitive intelligence unit to top officials within the Koch network, and it was sent in the run-up to the 2014 general election. Apparently, this was like a weekly memo that they would send out, that they would track all what the unions are doing and the Democratic campaigns and the environmental groups and Tom Steyer's super PAC. But they would also keep a close eye on what the NRSC was doing, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and the other super PACs and campaigns on the right, because they would want to know, hey, if they're interested in, you know, in a Republican Senate candidate winning in a certain state and the NRSC is pulling out of that state, which is a real example that was in this memo, hey, we need to go in. We need to send our, we need to offset what they are, the void that they're leaving with our own forces, our own advertising, our own ground troops. And so, you know, they are monitoring the public communications as well as the documents that these entities are required to file with the Federal Election Commission or state election watchdogs to figure out what not just what the left is doing, but what their ostensible allies and sometimes rivals on the right are doing. So that's a big part of it. That's a big part of it, incidentally, for not just the Kochs, but all these big money entities that are playing an increasing role in politics on both sides of the aisle, is figuring out how to toe the letter of the coordination ban and not run afoul of it while still being as up to speed as possible on what your allies and your opponents are doing in a way that, frankly, from a lay perspective, you look at it and you're like, that looks like coordination to me. But from a legal perspective, it dots all the I's and crosses all the T's.
Well, Ken Vogel, I thank you so much for this story. It's a pretty amazing story. And I guess if the Republicans crash and burn in 2016, if Trump or Carson take them down, the Kochs might be in a position to remake the Republican Party as a libertarian party. You've almost implied that could be a part of their strategy as well.
I think it is a part of their strategy, and it's not just if there's a disaster on the Republican
side.
Right. I mean, they're working to do this no matter who is the nominee.
Right.
And they want to, I mean, they would prefer if there were a nominee who sort of was simpatico with them on these issues and was a more libertarian-infused Republican.
Right.
But if there isn't, then I think they'll focus on the Senate. And you're right. If there isn't a Republican nominee who suits their liking, and whoever that nominee is loses, it might create even more of a void on the right in the Republican Party that the Kochs and their operation could step into.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Kenneth Vogel.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Vogel, who's a chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He is the author of Big Money, $2.5 Billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking of American Politics. And his latest article at Politico is The Koch Intelligence Agency. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing whether the West is giving Daesh, the Islamic State, exactly what they want.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man. Keith. Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Christopher Swift, who's a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia Center for National Security Law. His latest book is The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Swift.
Ian, good to be with you.
And the extent to which governors in the United States are closing the door on the possibility of Syrian refugees being resettled in their states, 34 governors so far have closed the door, if you will. The president, Obama, spent 90 minutes or so on the phone yesterday trying to convince them otherwise, that there's a vetting process that would prevent the kind of problems. And in fact, the president has described the reaction or the overreaction of these governors as being hysterical. What's your sense then of how much these kind of Islamophobic reactions play into the hands of the Daesh, the so-called Islamic State? Because my understanding is a part of their strategy is to drive a wedge between the Muslim diaspora and the local populations.
Yeah, no, that's very true, Ian. Look, the comments we're hearing from governors around the country show a tremendous degree of ignorance about how the screening process works, or they are representative of sort of a nativist demagoguery that finds currency among certain parts of the U.S. population. Look, by and large, the people who are going to make it out of Syria under the current conditions and who would get into a United Nations refugee camp and be screened for resettlement in the United States, these are going to be business owners, they're going to be professionals, they're going to be the kinds of people who had the wherewithal to get out of a horrifying war zone and get to a safer place, and then get through the U.S. Department of State and FBI screening process. So part of this is reacting to the news and reacting to the news without thinking very much about the law, which doesn't allow governors to do this sort of thing. And part of this also is not understanding how these messages that we tell ourselves inside the United States actually resonate with and reinforce the clash of civilizations narrative that ISIS and its allies are trying to project.
So do you think that given that we have an election season and obviously when Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz talk about we should only settle Christian refugees, which prompted the president to say that remark was shameful, how much does this have to do with the electoral politics and the constituency in Iowa, for example, that the Republican presidential candidates are perhaps pandering to?
Well, I don't want to call it pandering. I mean, if you look at Governor Bush's comments in particular, what he recommended was that they prioritize Christian refugees rather than screen out everybody who wasn't Christian. So I want to give him a little bit of a pass on that. But even the prioritization is sort of inappropriate in this instance. International refugee law, the international treaties that govern it, and the Immigration and Naturalization Act that we have here in the United States that implements some of those treaty obligations, it doesn't allow you to draw distinctions based on what someone's religion is. What it asks you to do is look at the political situation they are fleeing, whether they are threatened with death, threatened with persecution, and then make a purely humanitarian determination based on that. Now, if the person who is leaving a war zone is actually someone who's a victimizer or a human rights abuser or is a member of the Nazi Party or, you know, meets some other sort of criteria, including engaging in terrorism, they're not eligible under the law, whether international or U.S. law, for any kind of refuge or resettlement in the United States. They are eligible for being prosecuted for those particular crimes. So when we're looking at these issues, we really have to remember One, what does the law say? What parameters does the law create? What processes does it create? And two, we need to distinguish between the protections and processes that are set up in U.S. and international law and the way that these things are represented in the media or represented on the campaign trail to appeal to certain concerns and fears that may not be the actual problem that we're trying to solve.
Well, I'm not sure. Is it the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution that says there should be no religious test?
It's in the there's no religious test for office.
Right, I see.
And then the First Amendment to the Constitution says that it has both an establishment clause and a free exercise clause. The establishment clause says government shall not create and fund a religion or support a particular religion, but at the same time it says nor shall the U.S. government interfere with the free exercise of any religion.
Mm-hmm.
That's a balance we've had in this country for, going on 239 years. We've done a pretty good job of it. But when we lose sight of that, we lose sight of the thing that draws people here, and we lose sight of the higher standard that we use to distinguish the kinds of things that we do in our own interests from the sort of things that our adversaries like ISIS say they're doing in their interest. Look, one of the things that ISIS loves to do, and Al-Qaeda did it before them, Ian, is identify all of the areas where we're not living up to our own standards. And they do that to show that we are hypocritical and that there is no alternative to either the clash of civilizations narrative that they're giving people or the particularly brutal and narrow-minded interpretation of Islam that they've adopted. And groups like ISIS, what they like to do is take away the third option for people, take away, all the ambiguity and all the flexibility that usually, democratic societies and, the rule of law provide, and leave people with a black and white choice between them and whoever they say the adversary is. And when we make those kinds of black and white distinctions in our own politics, they turn around and use it against us. We're doing them a favor while we think we're protecting ourselves. We've got to be very careful about that.
And again, I'm speaking with Christopher Swift, who's a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia's Center for National Security Law. His latest book is The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. It's my understanding, Christopher, that the United States actually has the most successful integration of Muslims from abroad. And by contrast, France, which has, about a 5 million population of Muslims, mostly from North Africa, hasn't done so well, that the surrounding suburbs of Paris are vast sort of ghettos. And there's many have argued that there's kind of a breeding ground for the kind of activities that just took place on Friday in Paris. So how would you rate the U.S. in terms, even though we are not stepping up in terms of letting refugees in from Syria, clearly, but at the same time, my understanding is that America is something of a success story, which the Islamic world may not be aware of.
Well, I don't know if the Islamic world is or isn't aware of the distinction you're drawing, Ian, but what I can tell you is if you look at this purely from an integration standpoint and from a religious freedom standpoint, the United States has had substantially fewer problems of the kind that our allies in Western Europe have had, and the British are sort of in between. On the one hand, we tend to have much higher standards in terms of who we allow into the country from overseas, especially when it comes to refugee resettlement, than our counterparts in Western Europe do. But at the same time, we don't insist on sort of a radical secularism in the United States. In France, you can't wear a head covering, if you're a young woman going to school. Here in the United States, it's expected that if you're Jewish, you might wear a Star of David. If you're Christian, you might wear a cross. If you're a Muslim, you may, wear the hijab or some outward symbol of your inward belief. The First Amendment allows for that flexibility. It's a really remarkable piece of law in that it says the government is not going to pick sides and the government's going to let you follow your own faith and belief. The French kind of do that only insofar as the private space is concerned, the family space is concerned, but they're very uncomfortable with it in the public domain. The British are somewhere in between. that flexibility that we have in the United States allows people to find a place here that they would not necessarily be able to find in Western Europe. And it's important to note that, look, when we look at the marketplace of ideas, whether they're religious ideas or partisan ideas or political ideas or even scholarly ideas, we have a free market for that here in the United States. There isn't quite that free market where people can exchange ideas in Europe because of some of the blasphemy laws and because their approach to free speech and the free exercise of religion is more restrictive than ours.
So when these debates become political, as they are clearly, in terms of letting refugees in and closing the door, etc., a lot of the suggestions have mostly centered around the idea that the Islamic State are seeding the refugee flow with fighters, and that passport that's being used as an evidence from the island of Leros in Greece is not panning out from what I understand. Many suggest it may have been planted. But I don't think there's such a thing as 100% success in terms of creating a kind of full leak-proof system. After all, the Sanarov brothers are an example, are they not? And not only did they get the refugee status here in the United States or asylum, Russian intelligence also flagged them and somehow the ball was dropped.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how well Russian intelligence flagged them, to be honest. I think they did a lot of convenient flagging after the fact, if you follow my reasoning there. Look, there is no perfect system. But given the choice between someone who is fleeing an adversary, coming for them and their family, and looking for a better life, and someone who is dispossessed, failing at their job, failing in their family life, and self-radicalizing online, I think the second category of people is a much more clear and present danger from a homeland security standpoint, from a public safety standpoint, than our refugees. As someone who studies the radicalization process and occasionally consults with law enforcement, I'm much more worried about what young unemployed men are doing in their mother's basement online than I am worried about whether a Syrian refugee family comes to the United States and tries to set up a shop or tries to find a job at the local school or hospital. The radicalization that's happening online already within our own society is a much more serious concern than the kind of radicalization that we're projecting onto people who are fleeing our adversary.
So in terms of the work that you do on studying this migration from being a member of a society and then becoming literally somebody that wants to kill your fellow Americans, or in this case, your fellow French citizens, you mentioned the you're more afraid of the young man in his mother's basement online constantly. That's pretty much a description of the shooter that killed all those school kids in Connecticut.
That's very true.
So what is the distinction here in that regard?
Well, there's a difference between people who are suffering from a mental illness, and those people generally have not to be discriminatory towards people who have mental illnesses, but certain types of mental illnesses make people more susceptible to certain types of radicalization. But setting that aside, there's basically a three-stage process that every individual that ultimately commits a violent act goes through. And it doesn't matter whether they're doing it, for racist reasons like the Charleston shooting, or whether they're doing it for nominally religious reasons like the Paris attackers over the weekend. The three phases are self-identification with a community that they see as being threatened or under attack. They say, I am one of them. I am part of that group. What's happening to them is also happening to me. The second is the self-radicalization process. And you saw this with the older Tsarnaev brother, where not only is he identifying with Iraqis and Afghans, notwithstanding the fact that he's half Chechen, half Dagestani, and has never been to those societies, he then says, everything else that I'm hearing from my own community, in the mosque, in my neighborhood where I live, those people are wrong. They don't understand how the world really works. They take away the ability to engage in a dialogue about the issues and understand the distinctions between things. That's the radicalization process. And then the final process is the militarization process, the self-militarization process. That's when someone decides to stop receiving information or talking about their ideas and actually take violent action in furtherance of a particular political objective, whether it's to scare people, whether it's to create a caliphate, whether it is to, you know, get on television. That step towards action is the final phase. It doesn't happen without the first two phases happening. The part of the thing that makes me concerned about the discussion we're having about excluding Syrian refugees is it makes it easier for ISIS to tell a story that makes people that want to self-identify with ISIS and self-radicalize. It just becomes more compelling in that particular instance if the United States says it opens its doors to everyone except for Muslims. It opens, it supports the people of Syria except for when they need refuge. That contradiction reinforces those two phases of the radicalization process, and we need to be very, very careful about, you know, the consequences of the things we say publicly that play into our adversaries' hands.
Well, Christopher Swift, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Christopher Swift, who's a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia's Center for National Security Law. His latest book is The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad. We're going to take a brief station break, move back and go to Geneva, Switzerland, to discuss how much attitudes in Europe have changed towards the influx of refugees from Syria since the massacres in Paris.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah, war is not the answer. Politician and them bobo nighting, yeah. War is not the answer. I simply know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer. I simply know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer.
Seen enough now, it's time to decide the meekness of love or the power of pride. It doesn't matter if you're good or smart. God damn it, things fall apart.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Geneva, Switzerland, is Joel Millman, who's a press officer for the International Organization for Migration. He previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joel Millman.
Thank you, Bert.
And since the Paris slaughters of innocents, I take it there's been a shift in Europe in the attitude towards the migrants flooding in from Syria. So how is it affecting your work, and how palpable is this shift?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've heard this a few times from other hosts. A shift would imply that countries that had one position have changed them. The ones we hear about that say absolutely not, or we're talking about the links to jihad, of the same ones that were saying it a week ago, Hungary, Poland, you know, the kind of the tension between Germany EU members has not, I wouldn't call it a fundamental shift. One side feels vindicated, but others are saying what they've been saying all along, which is that there are many sources of conflict, many sources of violence, many sources of extremism, and to link this now with the traffic, you know, the travel across the Mediterranean and across the Balkans seems a little opportunistic, I think.
Well, you already have something of a split in Europe itself between the East and the West, between the Balkans and particularly Hungary, and the attitude
right. In
Austria and Germany, for example. So is that division being exacerbated?
Probably. I mean, there are probably people who either for cynical reasons will see that there's a lot more mileage, you know, from that position, especially for the right-wing parties. But others will say no. They may agree with what IOM has been saying for quite some time now, which is that what we need is a managed legal migration with vigilance on the borders, fingerprinting, checking records, if possible, wherever possible, moving people from a safe location in the Middle East or North Africa, and not doing it haphazardly while it's on the road. I mean, you know, both sides could say, well, this vindicates us, to the degree that we've been saying that this is a dangerous situation for the migrant and for the recipient countries because there is no solid, consistent management. Now, I mean, our case is strengthened, too. So does it harden positions? I don't know. It's also an opportunity for consensus.
Well, I'm trying here to get a kind of handle on what's happening in Europe because I suspect it's quite different from what's happening here. Even though the United States is taking in very few Syrian refugees, and of course the entire Atlantic Ocean separates the United States from Europe, not to mention the Mediterranean Ocean separating it from the Middle East.
Right.
You know, the president has had to basically rebuke, I think, 30-plus governors in this country who have closed the door on the very possibility of having 34 governors, as a matter of fact. And the president, Obama, has referred to them as being hysterical in their overreactions. And he's apparently spent 90 minutes on phone calls to these 34 governors trying to explain that to them how the vetting process works, et cetera.
Right.
So I'm calling you just to get the European reaction because I suspect it's not as Islamophobic as it is here.
Oh, it can be just as Islamophobic, depending on who you're talking to. First of all, I started out in the refugee work after college almost 40 years ago, at the time when Soviet, what they call refuseniks, were coming out of the Soviet Union, and the organization I worked for had protocol in place for when we suspected a false refusenik was coming through our system, you know, whether or not it was a KGB agent or somebody else. You know, there were trained people that expected to see this and knew what to do. Mariel Boatlift with the Cubans in 1980, obviously there's well-documented information about the role that this Boatlift played in helping some, very few, but some Cuban intelligence operatives come into the U.S., so this is not something that has been invented by the hysterical right, nor is it historically unusual. I mean, but it goes to my point that the authorities that vet and know what to look for in these cases do a pretty good job. And we can't think of any case of a sleeper cell that came in with a big refugee movement. Sure, there were Cuban agents embedded, some probably for years in some extreme cases, and they only were in the U.S. for 10 or 20 days after the Mariel Boatlift. Do we link scandalous, violent, terroristic acts to any of these refugee movements? Never. And what's important is for people to say now this is so frightening, it is to suggest that none of the professionals would know how to distinguish. And that's just simply not true. They do an excellent job of distinguishing. They know what to look for, and they know what to do to weed them out. So we'd like to weed them out before they get on a plane, but we don't get that opportunity if they're walking across, you know, the Balkans. So.
Right. Or washing ashore in Greece, where, you know, this passport, which many consider to be a forgery, that was found in one of the bodies in Paris, came through the island.
And that could have been picked up in Paris. You know, we don't know that passport then is proof that was someone who came in on this group. In fact, when I was on the Balkans a few weeks ago, we had a day where 14 different men from Iraq were using the same safe conduct paper. Their Greek was pretty good, so we thought they'd been in Greece for a few years. And this was one of these safe conduct papers that somebody got in Lesbos or Kos or one of the islands and allowed them to cross Greece, and somehow it got to a Xerox machine. There were 14 copies of it, and 14, maybe more, but that one day, 14 guys used the same piece of paper. What does this prove? That chaos isn't good, but not that they're coming in directly from Syria on these boats.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Joel Millman, who is a press officer for the International Organization for Migrants in Geneva, Switzerland. He previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. Of course, in relation to the Mariel Boatlift or the exodus from Cuba, where Castro emptied the jails and dumped a whole bunch of really bad people on the shores of the United States. Jimmy Carter, of course, settled a number of them in Arkansas against the advice of the current governor at the time, Bill Clinton, who as a result lost his re-election. It's widely considered because of this. So you can't discount...
I think it was Conway, Arkansas, which was the same location where Japanese were interned in World War II, so it's kind of really scraping up, unpleasant American history.
Right, and the Germans were also interned there, German POWs. So just back then to the refugee crisis, is it still a crisis? What kind of flows are coming in as we speak?
Well, they're stronger, obviously, than we'd like them to be this time of year because of the dangerous sea conditions, but... We estimate our number for the last 3 years combined is 1.1 million across the Mediterranean, and almost three quarters of that is just this year. So last year, which we thought was an enormous year, has been surpassed. I think quadrupled, or very nearly quadrupled, and 2013's 42,000, which looked like a lot. And 24 months ago, now seems like a day in the park.
So when the head of the European Union, Donald Tusk, accuses Russia of causing an uptick in the flow of refugees out of Syria because of its bombing campaign, is there any evidence from your point of view to support that?
A lot of reporters ask me about it. We have kicked it around, informally with reporters and with experts at IOM, and most, I think, have come to agree that after 10 months that Kobani siege last year was probably the most important turning point. That is when we began to see whole neighborhoods, whole families, whole extended families arriving on these landings and explaining to debriefers that they had sold all their livestock, sold their homes, sold their jewelry, point of no return, which we had not been hearing. The profile out of Libya was a guy who was either a guest worker in the oil fields in Libya or washing cars, and all his family and all his past was sort of back in some sub-Saharan country, and then he was making a bold break to save himself from the violence in Libya. You weren't seeing people who'd cashed out everything to come to Europe. We began to see that in the early part of this year, after the Kobani siege began. So I'm sure the Russian bombing has not made people feel any more secure, but to say that's the turning point, I think, ignores what we saw on the ground.
So what do you think happened at the G20 recent conference that just ended in Turkey? My understanding is that Erdogan feels that the Turks have had to spend quite a lot of money on maintaining refugee camps, and clearly at a certain point these camps have sort of opened the floodgates, if you will, and people made that hazardous journey across the Mediterranean. Some have accused Erdogan of sort of trying to blackmail the Europeans, but on the other hand...
I wasn't at the conference, so I can't really speak authoritatively, but I say that the Turks learned what everyone learned, which was that the Kobani siege was a turning point, and our director has talked about Turkey's role, exemplary, as for the last 4 years. All the countries that border Syria have acted exemplary. They've all kept their borders open and welcomed people at an enormous cost. I mean, look at a country like Jordan with a much smaller population, water deficit, it's something like 10 million liters a day are being consumed in some of these refugee settlements. This is very expensive for a country like that to have these people there. At no time have they closed the border. Libya's neighbors never closed the border. So personally, and also from the point of view of someone that works at IOM, I don't think there's a lot of criticism to meet out with Turkey or any other of the neighbors in the region. Obviously, everyone would have liked much more effort made to a ceasefire, but sometimes that's beyond the ability of neighboring countries like this.
Well, a lot of the Republican politicians running for president and the governors who've closed the door on Syrian refugees, they're arguing, of course, that it would make more sense to take care of these refugees near Syria, just on, across the border.
That has happened by the millions. That has been happening.
Right.
There's no question that millions of people are being taken care of in these camps.
Well, but
they're also on the move.
Sure, but my question would be, has the United States put its money where its mouth is? Have they backed up that idea of keeping people in the region with funds to the UNHCR, et cetera, and to Europe?
Absolutely. I mean, the U.S. is probably the largest donor in the world for this kind of crisis. You know, the PRM at State Department has an enormous budget for this kind of thing. I mean, there's money. I don't want to use the term that's in vogue with the right wing, you know, the throwing money at the problem, but there's plenty of money being thrown locally. There's no question about it. Donors from all over the world, including, you know, government, including the United States or USAID or different organizations. There's no shortage of funding. There is a shortage, there's a shortfall, but there's no shortage of let's say, philosophical understanding that this kind of thing has to be faced right there on the ground. I mean, you go to a place like Preševo in Serbia, where I was a few weeks ago, and, you know, there are people who do nothing but think of ways to inexpensively winterize, an abandoned factory close to the border, so that when 2,000 people come through on a day where it's the first snowfall, there will be no pictures of frozen babies. You know, this is something that people were thinking about in September and August, and they know how to get the money for it, and they know where the donors are. So there's not a question of, but there is a long-term reality, which I think organizations like IOM are trying to explain, you know, to anyone who will listen to us, that these people are going to keep coming. The average stay in a refugee camp or resettlement, waiting for resettlement, has grown to 17 years worldwide, and people are arriving as kids and having their own kids in those camps. And for better or for worse, the human trafficking and human smuggling industry is so much more efficient today than it was 20 years ago, probably because of cell phones and Facebook and all kinds of money transferring systems all over the world, that no ambitious person or even sentient person is going to stand for that anymore. So to say that's what we should do is just spend more money to keep people in refugee camps, they're not going to do it. They're not going to stay. I mean, thousands of people began showing up at the U.S. border a few years ago in numbers and from countries that we'd never seen before. And they asked for asylum. They said that the only thing that's different between me waiting in a camp for you to choose me and me coming and saying my rights under international conventions is that you have to process me. The only difference is a handful of dollars, you know, maybe $5,000, $10,000 covers that entire gap, which any ambitious immigrant can work in a gas station all night, can work in a nursing home, can wash dishes. People can raise that money absolutely in no time once they come to America. And the smugglers know this, and they know it. So it's unrealistic to say, let's spend the money to keep them over there, because they're not going to stay. Not when it takes 17 years to get resettled, and it will take longer than that if you try to do it with this number of people.
So just back to the attitudes in Europe and how much they may have changed vis-a-vis the welcoming of refugees since the slaughters in Paris. You know, there's been a tendency for, particularly under George Bush and Dick Cheney, to take bin Laden's bait, arguably. He wanted the Christian armies to invade the Muslim lands to justify his actions.
Yeah.
And we were very obliging, at least the Bush administration were very obliging.
And some of the officers even used those terms.
Right. So
they didn't last, those guys.
Right. But is there, I mean, my understanding of these tactics of the Daesh, the Islamic State, is that they want to drive a wedge between the Muslim diaspora in Europe and the rest of the population. And are the authorities, particularly in France, in any way obliging the Islamic State strategy, as Bush and Cheney did oblige?
They struck the airstrikes. You know, that could be interpreted that way, I suppose, by some people. Other people would say it was an appropriate immediate response to a tragedy that shows you mean business. I don't really weigh in on an opinion on either side. I think it'd be interesting to go back in history I was telling another reporter today about the famous 1938, I think it was 38 or 39, Act of Congress trying to get 300, I think it was 300 Jewish children visas to leave Germany, and congressmen voted it down. They said, can't have it, can't open the floodgates, can't accept even these little kids who won't be little kids forever. And that was sort of the rhetoric. It was a bitter defeat for the for some of the Democrats who were pushing for this, but it really spelled the long-term doom for the Republicans with that immigrant community. And we're seeing, but it'd be interesting to go back and see whether or not people who were bitterly opposed to Roosevelt use the excuse that he's an incompetent and he wouldn't know how to resettle these people. I think they were acting on naked prejudice and didn't mind Pete and their vote of their constituents knowing that about them. Today, that's changed. Now, they're very careful to say, you know, personally, I'm not a bigot, or personally, I think religious freedom goes for everybody. However, we can't afford this Trojan horse, as Trump likes to say, and we have no confidence that the Hillary Clinton, Kerry, State Department can vet them and operate a system like that. And if you look at the right-wing blogosphere, I saw something today, Hillary's Syrian rebels invade New Orleans, and I think it's 14 people have been identified as resettled there. And I tweeted on it today. I mean, this is you see this daily now in the right-wing blogosphere, and someone's gotten the idea that they got the list of the State Department authorized cities where migrants can go, where refugees can be resettled, and it's not a very complicated list. It's over a certain size. That's a city that's considered eligible for resettlement. And people are acting like these are now being targeted, that Al-Qaeda or ISIS in cahoots with the Kerry State Department are now targeting these cities. I mean, this isn't pandering to the most delusional kind of birther attitude.
Sure.
I don't know what is, but, you know, that's what we've come to. So what are you going to do?
Well, but here in the U.S., we've had presidential candidates, Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush, saying that the United States should only admit Christian refugees.
They said the same thing in Hungary. They said the same thing in Hungary and the Czech Republic this year, a few weeks ago. It's not unusual.
No, I know, but I'm saying that this prompted President Obama to say that is shameful, which it really is.
Of course.
So,
but, I mean, they want to win the Iowa caucus, and the Iowa caucus tends to be run by a strong evangelical candidate, Huckabee, Santorum. I mean, You can't explain this out of the context of these guys want to be president.
Right.
The way to become president is to get a good head start in the caucuses. The way to get that is to say only Christian.
Yeah, or pander, as I would say, pander to the American Taliban. But
it's transparent and it's something that I hope our children will shame us for it. But.
Right.
We shouldn't waste a lot of time explaining why this happened.
Exactly. Well, Joel Milman, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you again. And again, I've been speaking with Joel Milman, who is a press officer for the International Organization for Migration in Geneva, Switzerland. He previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.